Hi, welcome to the Growth.me summary of The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. The True Believer shows how the same human frustrations drive all mass movements, whether they are social, political, or religious. People join mass movements to escape their ineffectual and helpless individual self. Eric Hoffer wrote this book 70 years ago, but it's still frighteningly relevant today. Our top quote from this book is, "Faith in a holy cause is to a considerable extent a substitute for the lost faith in ourselves." End quote. Why do people join mass movements like communism, nationalism, or fascism? Why do millions of people march in the streets for social, political, or religious movements? Why do millions of people sometimes decide to follow a single leader fanatically? Eric Hoffer tries to answer all these questions in The True Believer. This book was first published in 1951, when the memories of people like Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini were still fresh in everyone's minds. And people wanted to understand where these movements came from, why they gripped millions of people, and how they were able to cause horrific events like the Holocaust. Why should we care about this book? Well, as best-selling author Simon Sinek says, if you don't understand people, then you don't understand business. And when we understand the psychology of mass movements, then we'll better know what inspires people and motivates them to action. And this will help us to become better leaders, communicators, and citizens. Who was Eric Hoffer? He was born in 1902, a long time ago, and he's not someone we would typically expect to write an insightful book about human nature and social issues. You see, for most of his life, Eric Hoffer worked a variety of working-class jobs, including being a longshoreman in San Francisco for 25 years. But along the way, he wrote 10 books, many of which have been praised by professors, diplomats, and regular readers like you and me. In 1983, he received the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom for his work, primarily for this book. So let's get started with the first lesson from this summary of The True Believer, which is number one, all mass movements appeal to the same personal frustrations. A mass movement is what Eric Hoffer calls all social, political, and religious movements for change. A true believer is what he calls the enthusiastic members of these movements. For example, a Christian crusader, Russian communist, or Japanese nationalist would all be called true believers of their mass movements. Hoffer says that while mass movements may look very different on the surface, they are all driven by the same aspects of human psychology. To put it simply, all mass movements gain followers by appealing to a common set of personal emotions, frustrations, and motivations. And this is true whether the movement results in good or evil in the end. To illustrate this point, consider communists and national socialists. Most people see them as two political extremes which are totally opposite to one another. Yet when we look back in history to Germany during the 1920s and 30s, it was very common to see the true believers of communism becoming national socialists and vice versa. How is this possible? Well, because, like we've said, they're both mass movements and they both appeal to similar human motivations. Now here's a quote from this book. "Hitler looked on the German communists as potential national socialists. He said, the petit bourgeois social democrat and the trade union boss will never make a national socialist, but the communist always will. Captain Rom boasted that he could turn the reddest communist into a glowing nationalist in 4 weeks. On the other hand, Karl Radek look on the Nazi brown shirts as a reserve for future communist recruits, end quote. Hundreds and thousands of years ago, the most popular mass movements were religious. That's how Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism grew from small movements to worldwide forces. 1,000 years ago, the Catholic Pope was considered the most powerful man in Europe and probably the world. Yet in more recent history, the powerful movements have been more nationalist and social. For example, Gandhi's nationalist movement in India freed hundreds of millions of people from British rule, and today many people call him Father of the Nation. Nationalism also drove the American Revolution of Independence, the French Revolution for Democracy, and the destruction of World War II and the rapid modernization of Japan, all driven by different types of nationalism. Okay, so here's a summary of the first lesson. All mass movements appeal to similar human frustrations, whether they are political, social, or religious. That's why in 1930s Germany, the communists and national socialists would sometimes switch sides. Now, lesson two. People join mass movements when they feel frustrated and powerless. People who feel appreciated by others and in control of their life don't usually want to join a mass movement. If someone feels fulfilled and effective, then they probably want the world to stay mostly the same or slowly improve. They don't want radical change because they're happy to pursue their own goals and dreams within the existing system. And most importantly, they believe they have the power to improve their life through their individual effort. On the other hand, a true believer who becomes part of a mass movement feels frustrated, forgotten, and individually powerless. Alone, they feel vulnerable and undefended against the dangers and uncertainties of life. They don't believe their life can improve through individual action, so they want to join a holy cause to regain a sense of power in the world and some hope for their future. You see, it's human nature for people to usually blame their failures and on things outside of themselves. Perhaps this is one way we can preserve our self-respect when we're not doing well in life. So people who are failing will always say that it's the fault of the economy, the system, the government, capitalism, high taxes, etc. Anything outside of themselves. So when a mass movement comes along preaching systemic change and collective action as the answer to our problems, it greatly appeals to this part of human nature. Here's a summary of this lesson. Joining a movement gives a frustrated and hopeless person a sense of power again. They are encouraged to blame their inadequacies on things outside of themselves. People who feel fulfilled and in control of their life don't care to change the existing system. And now lesson three. People join mass movements to become free of their individual self. In the modern developed world, most of us would say more freedom is good. Freedom of expression, freedom from those in power, and freedom to do what we want. So how can we make sense of history when millions of people appeared to want the opposite? When they elected strongman leaders, tyrannical governments, and promoted strict social control? Well, when people feel powerless and frustrated, the freedom they deeply ache for is a freedom from individual responsibility. If someone doesn't feel they have the ability to create fulfillment in their life, then freedom becomes a problem. It's a constant reminder they don't measure up. In that situation, it feels like a relief to surrender responsibility to a powerful leader or organization. More than anything, a true believer wants to lose awareness of their inadequate individual self and become an anonymous member of a collective unified group. Here's a quote. To the frustrated, freedom from responsibility is more attractive than freedom from restraint. They are eager to barter their independence for relief from the burdens of willing, deciding, and being responsible for inevitable failure. End quote. When World War II ended, almost every Nazi member believed they were not guilty of the horrific crimes that had been committed. This only makes sense when we understand they had joined the movement to be free from individual accountability, and now they felt cheated when they were told to accept responsibility for what they had done while obeying orders. That wasn't part of the deal. So here's a summary of this lesson. Joining a larger movement lets someone drop individual responsibility and accountability. They can become free of individual scrutiny and feelings of inadequacy. Most Nazis didn't feel responsible for the atrocities that had been committed by the movement as a whole. Lesson 4. The new poor are most likely to join mass movements. When we hear that someone is very powerless and discontent, we probably imagine a very poor person, someone who is stressed about having enough money to feed themselves or their kids each day. But Eric Hoffer says that very poor people usually don't join mass movements for the simple reason their life is already energized with purpose. You see, when someone is struggling to survive, then every small action they take feels incredibly full of meaning. Every day they are engaged in keeping their family sheltered and fed, and so every small success, like a full stomach at the end of the day, feels deeply rewarding. It's true their life is hard and difficult, but it is also very meaningful. The psychologist Viktor Frankl wrote the amazing book Man's Search for Meaning, which talks about the lessons he learned surviving a concentration camp during World War II. In those camps, he discovered the importance of finding a meaningful purpose to life beyond just pleasure or consumption. Frankl wrote, quote, "What man actually needs is not a tensionless state, but rather the striving and struggling for a worthwhile goal, a freely chosen task," end quote. You can learn more in our summary of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl at growth.me. But back to this book. The new poor are a different group of people than the extremely poor. They are anyone in society that used to be doing well, but now are relatively worse off, and the new poor are the most likely to join mass movements. You see, the new poor are the groups that used to have more income, more security, or social status, but now they have less. And when we feel that our life is declining outside of our control, that is the most stressful and frustrating experience. And this explains why some homeless people can live with almost nothing for many years. But when a stock trader suddenly feels like they're losing everything they used to have, they may want to commit suicide. It's that feeling of our life declining. For example, most experts were surprised by the 2016 election of Donald Trump as president of the United States. Looking at the states he flipped in that election, it was clear he managed to persuade a large group of blue-collar working-class people to vote for him. Specifically, those were the Rust Belt states like Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. In America, there were many groups of new poor people in those states. You see, decades ago, working in manufacturing was one of the best jobs in those areas of the country. Yet slowly, all of those jobs were being transferred to overseas factories where the labor costs were much cheaper, and worst of all, no politicians seemed to really care. Instead, they were all promoting more free trade agreements, and so those blue-collar workers felt their status and security in society slipping, and their future was very uncertain. So it seemed like Donald Trump recognized this group of highly frustrated people, and he spoke to them with promises of more strict borders, fairer trade deals, and higher taxes on imports. Whether you like him or hate him, it was because of Trump that the controversial TPP free trade deal was not signed, and during his presidency, he waged many trade wars to totally renegotiate major trade agreements like NAFTA. So that was one way that appealing to a core group of the new poor was able to perhaps change an election. Okay, and finally, the new poor can also include those people who used to be extremely poor, but now their conditions have improved a little. Yet instead of feeling more satisfied, this improvement has now highlighted all the ways their life is still lacking. For example, the communist revolution in Russia didn't happen when the peasants were at their most poor, but only after they had experienced a significant improvement in their conditions and freedom. But that improvement had highlighted all the ways their life was still lacking. Here's another quote from this book. "Discontent is likely to be highest when misery is bearable, when conditions have so improved that an ideal state seems almost within reach. It is not actual suffering, but the taste of better things which excites people to revolt." End quote. A summary of this lesson: the new poor are the most frustrated group of people in societies. They are those people whose income, security, and status have recently fallen, or those who have just risen from the most extreme poverty. In both cases, it's the taste of a better life that motivates them to join mass movements. And now lesson 5. Passionate hate unifies members of a mass movement. It doesn't matter which country you live in. The politicians are masters of stirring up passionate anger or hatred. You'll always see left-wing politicians yelling about how rich people don't pay enough taxes, or right-wing politicians shouting about how the government is wasting our money. They know that strong emotions will motivate more people to go and vote for them. Now, every mass movement takes this to another level, and it nurtures a fanatical hatred against someone or some group of people. For the communists, it was the property-owning bourgeoisie or the kulaks in Russia. For the National Socialists, it was the Jewish people. For Christianity, it was probably Satan, as the enemy who secretly hides inside our heads every moment, tempting us to do bad things. Here's a quote: "Mass movements can spread without belief in a god, but never without belief in a devil." When Hitler was asked whether he thought the Jew must be destroyed, he answered, "No, we should have then to invent him. It is essential to have a tangible enemy, not merely an abstract one." End quote. An enemy also serves as an effective scapegoat, allowing a true believer to redirect attention from their own shortcomings. All their personal failures in life can be blamed on this enemy. And all the failures of the movement to accomplish their collective goals can also be blamed on the enemy. when millions of people died in famines due to the Soviet Union's new policies, Stalin blamed the kulaks, which were sort of the middle-class people who owned property. And by the way, Jordan Peterson, he's a psychology professor and best-selling author. Around 2018, he received a lot of attention for standing up against speech controls and censorship being promoted by political far-left groups. In his earlier book, Maps of Meaning, he explained the purpose of traditional myths across many cultures, and he said that myths, they highlight the ways that we should all live to create a better world. And he also wrote about the danger of not accepting personal responsibility for our own life frustrations. Here's a quote from him. "Obviously, if I am determined to overlook my own part in the failure to resolve my own frustrations, if I am determined to find a scapegoat for my problems, then I am just a stone's throw away from the mentality that was responsible for Hitler's Final Solution, or for the Spanish Inquisition, or for Lenin's cultural cleansing," end quote. And you can read more insights like that in our summary of Maps of Meaning by Jordan Peterson at growth.me. And now a summary of this lesson. Leaders of mass movements have always stoked anger by redirecting blame towards a common enemy, like wealthy people, the Jews, etc. This is one of the most effective ways to unite a group of people together. Okay, now we have lesson 6. Men of words, prepare the ground for every mass movement. According to Eric Hoffer, every mass movement has 3 stages, and each stage requires a different leader. First is the man of words, second is the fanatic, and third is the man of action. We're going to understand and explain each of these one by one. So let's start with the man of words. This is usually an intellectual who criticizes the established institutions, casts doubt on the old beliefs, and undermines the existing order. The man of words, he prepares the ground for every mass movement by planting seeds in the minds of a society, which later grow into the movement. However, they don't organize the movement themselves. Some examples of men of words include Jesus. He planted the seeds which would become Christianity, but he never organized the building of the churches himself. That happened after he had died. Next is Karl Marx. He never created a communist economy. He just wrote and published books, and then later others took his ideas and then attempted to do that. And also Martin Luther, in the 1500s, he undermined the Catholic Church's authority with his writings, and later that gave birth to an enormous number of Protestant Christian communities. Now there are thousands and thousands of them around the world. And by the way, almost 100 years ago, Edward Bernays wrote the book Propaganda, which talks in more detail about how these sort of new ideas can spread in the minds of people. Edward Bernays is often called the father of public relations, and his writing provides a clear insight into both political propaganda and advertising. You see, today we often hear about influencer marketing. This is when a company pays someone with a large social media audience to use their product. Yet even a century ago, Edward Bernays was explaining similar strategies. For example, he said that society was made up of many overlapping subcultures, which all have their own leaders, and that, quote, "if you can influence the leaders, either with or without their conscious cooperation, you automatically influence the groups which they sway," end quote. And you can learn more like that in our summary of the book Propaganda by Edward Bernays. Now let's get back to this book. Men of words weaken existing communal bonds. You see, when people don't want to join a mass movement, if they already feel protected and belonging to an existing tightly knit tribe, whether that's their family or a local tribe or religious group, and it's well known that communism, for example, attacks the authority of the parents and the family unit, and even Jesus talked about how he had come to divide children against their fathers and mothers. Now, the men of words usually have the best of intentions, and they do usually want to make the world a better place, but their work always has major unexpected consequences. You see, undermining existing social institutions creates a vacuum of meaning in people's lives, and this is fertile soil for even more fanatical mass movements to take root. Now, here are a couple quotes from this book again. When we debunk a fanatical faith or prejudice, we do not strike at the root of fanaticism. We merely prevent its leaking out at a certain point, with the likely result that it will leak out at some other point. And here's another quote. The Frenchman of the Enlightenment, who debunked the church and the crown and preached reason and tolerance, released a burst of revolutionary and nationalist fanaticism which has not abated yet, end quote. Okay, so a summary of this lesson. The first stage of every mass movement is led by men of words who undermine existing social institutions and group bonds. They plant seeds which later grow into the new movements. Now we have lesson 7. Fanatics bring new mass movements into being. The second stage of every mass movement is led by a fanatic who excites millions of people into organized action. He must come at the right time and fill people with hope and the vision of a glorious future. The fanatic often promises things which are impractical or impossible, but this is not a problem for those true believers. Remember, they are looking for a holy cause to lose their self inside of, rather than a practical and realistic plan. When someone believes heaven on earth is just around the corner, they are very willing to sacrifice everything they have in the present to get there. A great hope is required to overcome the natural human resistance to change. A summary of this lesson. The second stage of every movement is led by a fanatic who motivates masses of people into unified action. He fills them with hope of a glorious future coming soon. And lesson 8 is men of action stabilize mass movements. The last stage of every mass movement is led by men of action who bring structure and order. They cause the once spontaneous revolution to become sealed into new establishment, with clear rules, rituals, and hierarchies. For example, the American Revolution became the U.S. government, the Christian movement became the church, and so forth and so on. The early days of every mass movement are always explosive, dynamic, and free-flowing. For example, early Christianity borrowed many ideas from pagan religions like Easter and the Christmas tree. It was very dynamic. Yet as the movement became mature, and as every movement becomes mature, it hardens into a more solid, unchanging structure and traditions. These structures exist until another mass movement will eventually come along to reshape them. As they say, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. Summary of this lesson. The third stage is led by men of action, who sealed the once dynamic mass movement into a solid structure that can last. As every religious movement eventually becomes an organized religion, and every political revolution becomes a new government, Okay, so that's pretty much all for this summary. This is a very unconventional book to study. It's part history, part psychology, part politics. However, I do think it provides many insights about human nature that you won't hear almost anywhere else. But how can we use this knowledge, from this book in the real world? Well, first, we can notice when political leaders are trying to provide us with scapegoats for our personal shortcomings and problems. That's a big warning sign that they're trying to tap into powerful human motivations to gain power for themselves. Second, we can also use these ideas to create more unity within the groups that we are part of, including our families and our colleagues or our businesses. For example, in the book Start With Why, the author Simon Sinek explains that companies that become great always have a deeper purpose that unifies all their leaders, employees, and customers together. They need to have that deeper purpose. In that book, Simon Sinek wrote, "Very few people or companies can clearly articulate why they do what they do. When I say why, I don't mean to make money. That's a result. By why, I mean what is your purpose, cause, or belief? Why does your company exist? Why do you get out of bed in the morning? And why should anyone care?" End quote. Answering questions like these can help us build stronger and more meaningful bonds with the members of our communities, whether it's our coworkers, our employees, our families, or our other communities. So I recommend you check out our full summary of Start With Why by Simon Sinek to learn more. Okay, and I'll see you in the next book summary.